Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. God willing, we have a little bit of going to the places that the audio is supposed to go. We had a little bit of a mixer meltdown before we got started tonight. So unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do the live conversation part with the Twitter Spaces chunk. But God willing, you'll be able to all hear me on the Twitter Spaces, and hopefully you'll be able to hear the video as well. We will see what we see as we go through things. Now the headphones are plugged in and I can hear myself. It has not at all been a train wreck today. We got a lot to talk about tonight. There has been, despite the fact that Danielle Smith is reportedly out of the province on vacation at a tropical destination, it's still been a pretty nutty week in Alberta politics. And despite her absence, she still managed to have quite an impact. I want to start out talking about the fact that it is officially Black History Month. I had the privilege of being able to attend a event on the first that was an incredible conversation involving a bunch of different people in regards to Black History Month. Dr. Jared Wesley was there. He's been on the show before, and I just absolutely loved listening to him, as well as the other guests whose names, I apologize, escape me at the moment. But there were a couple other people who wanted to celebrate and recognize Black History Month, and the Premier of Alberta was no exception. So she tweeted out on the first, at varying times. Initially, she tweeted out, each February we mark the start of Black History Month here in Alberta, celebrating the stories and contributions of our Black communities in our province. There have been no shortage of people who have expressed a significant amount of concern in regards to Danielle Smith and her use of possessive pronouns, let's say. So Danielle Smith likes to say our Indigenous people, and apparently she likes to say our Black communities. But when we're talking about people who have been literally owned and traded, that's maybe not a great way to go. She did later on in the day at 2:15 go in and delete the original tweet, put a new one up. Apparently the Premier can't afford Twitter Blue. Whatever. And she changed it. Each February, we mark the start of Black History Month here in Alberta, celebrating the stories and contributions of Black communities in our province. The only problem was she used the same video. So she changed the surface of the tweet. But the video still included the use of our Black communities. And again, this is not something that Smith received feedback on before. There have been plenty of Indigenous folks and First Nations folks who have said, hey, you know what? That's super not cool. Please don't do that. But she used to do it. So listening and learning from her mistakes, I guess. Moving on from there. One of the things that Danielle Smith campaigned on aggressively was the idea that she was going to put together a COVID advisory group. This COVID advisory group, this COVID advisory board, was going to make sure that any decisions in regards to COVID or really anything else going forward, they were going to give her the good advice, the real advice. She talked about maybe using some Trump advisors. She threw around a couple other names. And we had a press conference this week where we saw the Minister of Health, Jason Copping, making some announcements in regards to some changes that he wanted to make for the EMS system. So the announcement was they're going to include HealthLink nurses in the dispatching process so that hopefully people who don't actually need an ambulance get redirected to HealthLink. Maybe that offloads some of the folks that are not necessarily requiring an ambulance. Doesn't do a whole heck of a lot for those hundreds of empty shifts that we keep hearing about from HSAA. But he did have a bunch of stuff to say. And we're gonna work our way through some of those things. But just keep in mind, the big promise from Danielle Smith is going to be COVID advisory. Going to be great.
Paul, on the Premier's first day in office, she announced Hinshaw was out, and I will be guided by a team, I'll say public health advice from a team of scientific advisors. The Premier's office told me in a statement a month later that the Premier's working directly with you to assemble this team, and it would be ready by Christmas. That didn't happen. And last week, the Premier's office told me that actually the team's not coming together because we're going to take advice from Preston Manning, which would suggest we're getting medical scientific advice from Preston Manning. I'm not sure how that would work, but I guess my question is, what happened to the panel, sir?
Yeah, so as the Premier's office indicated to you, she has asked Preston Manning and to look at the Alberta government's response, and then how do we improve that going forward? So that work is being done, and as well as she has asked me in terms of my mandate letter and working with the HQCA to look at the data. So assessment of the data that was used to be able to measure the impact on Alberta, and then how do we improve that going forward? So that is the work that is being done.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but that's not what you guys promised. You promised an ongoing panel of scientific and medical advisors. That is not happening. Why not, sir?
So that is not happening. What our focus is on doing an assessment for, as the Premier indicated, a panel led by Preston Manning to assess the, what we did during the pandemic, and how do we, what tools that we need from a legislative standpoint, for example, in terms of how to better manage that going forward, and then taking a look at the data through the HQCA. So that's, the data in terms of the HQCA is in my mandate letter, and that's what I'm focused on as a Minister of Health.
There you go. So not so much with the COVID advisory panel, but much more with the Preston Manning, because, of course, we're going with Preston Manning to give us the advice of how to deal with the pandemic. What with his 50 Shades of COVID fan fiction that he did a little while ago. And this has created quite a bit of controversy, particularly around Smith's base, because there were a lot of people who felt like they had access to the real evidence and they wanted to make sure that that's what was guiding Smith's decisions. Well, she's now said, no, I'm just going to go with whatever Preston tells me. And then apparently, according to Mr. Copping, what Mr. Copping and Alberta Health tell him to tell Danielle Smith. So with the exception of the injection Preston Manning into the equation, it doesn't look like a whole heck of a lot has changed. What's fascinating, though, is that nowhere in that, or did it include the fact that there was, we still have a chief medical officer of health. That's still a thing in the province of Alberta. That wasn't included in that conversation at all. And that's the person who, through legislative power and legislative authority, has all the power to make all of the decisions during an emergency like a pandemic. So it's a fascinating little conversation that they have going on. But there was a lot more that went on during that press conference as well. And in particular, I want to take a quick second to talk about Danielle Smith's, as we've taken to call it at the show, Danielle Smith's drug problem.
Yeah, so the it was approved. The shipment was approved. Like the remaining shipment is approved. My understanding is, but it's still subject to final approvals for the labels. So even though the dosage was approved and the overall shipment was approved, it hasn't been approved for shipment here to Alberta. So we're waiting with Health Canada for the labels get approved, and then we'll have a better timeline on how much acetaminophen, how much ibuprofen, all the details. We haven't got all that yet. So it's a positive step forward. Like we got the dosage approved, but we still have a few more steps to get through before we can finalize all the questions and know what the timelines of it coming in. I am hopeful it is days, but I've been hopeful for a while, but yeah, I'm hopeful that it's days.
So it's approved. It's totally approved. All of the things are approved. The only problem that we have is that it's not technically proved. I mean, this whole thing has been incredibly bungled since day one. The Premier announced after she beat up a lector, and the Premier announced that she was going to be buying all of these drugs that didn't actually make them. They guaranteed that they were going to be here before Christmas. And then it came out, well, the company doesn't actually make them. They make the precursor. We have to go through the process of getting all of the approvals to get this company to actually make the drugs, which they used to have, but it turns out most of their approvals in order to sell in Canada are expired. So they have to go through that whole approval process. And then we found out, oh, oops, we forgot to include the child-proof labels, because apparently nobody thought that when you're selling children's medicine over the counter, that's one of the requirements, because it is. And then there were delays and delays. And then it was, well, you know what, the label thing, apparently you have to have the label in English and French if you want to sell it to the entire country, which is what they want to do. There's a lot of people who have said, hey, you know what, the label, it's the drugs are for Alberta. Why do we need a French label? Well, A, there's a lot of people who speak French in Alberta. We do live in a country with two national languages, and there's no reason to disrespect them like that. But secondary to that, one of the things that Smith said is they had to do a minimum order of 5 million bottles. You can do the math. There's only like 4 million and change people in Alberta. Most of them aren't children. So there's no way that those bottles, all of that medication, is going to be used in Alberta. And Smith said, no, don't worry about that. It's cool. We're going to sell it to the rest of Canada. It's all good. They're going to want to buy it. So it's not just that the labels need to be present in order for the meds to be used in Alberta. It's also a question of they have to be present in order to sell them to the rest of the country to recoup some of the costs, of which we still don't know the answers to how much there are, but we know there's a lot. Because one of the things that Smith and Copping have been very open about is, hey, you know what, guys, we paid a premium. So we paid extra in order to secure these meds. Well, one of the questions came up. So it seems like maybe the crisis is over. Here's Copping's answer. That's not Copping's answer. Here's Copping's answer.
I'm just wondering, at what point, you know, are you worried that there's not going to be as much of a need or desire for these sort of medications to come to Alberta, because it's been already 2 months since the original announcement?
Yeah, so we are on ongoing conversations with the pharmacy community. There still is a shortage here, so we are quite comfortable that, you know, for Alberta, that we will still need the shipments. And it's and again, the shelf life on this is 2 years, so it's not just about this season, it's about next season as well. In addition, we're continuing to work with other provinces should they have need, and we'll be able to share that as well.
The pharmaceutical community says there's still a shortage, except no, they don't. The pharmaceutical community is pretty clear. The shortage is resolved. The supply chain issues are resolved. And you can go to pretty much any pharmacy in Alberta, and you can find that the medications that you're looking for, whether we're talking about ibuprofen or whether we're talking about Tylenol, those are available. Now, not all pharmacies are stocking them on the shelves. A lot of them are still stocking them behind the counter. So you have to go up to the pharmacist and say, excuse me, I would like some children's Tylenol. And they say, okay, here you go. And that's it. But they're still available. So it begs the question, where is Minister Copping getting his information and his advice from? Because it certainly seems like perhaps he's a little bit maybe out of touch with what's actually going on, because that article is actually from a couple weeks ago. The issue has been resolved for quite a while. And even if Minister Copping wants to say, and Danielle Smith want to say, you know what, it's cool, because next year we're going to need Tylenol too. People are going to want to buy children's Tylenol when the flu season hits. If you don't think that the major corporations like Tylenol are not already preparing for that and not already planning for that, you are grossly underestimating how corporations go about doing their business. They're probably a little choked that the government decided to force Alberta Health Services, in effect, to buy the Tylenol from Atabey Pharmaceuticals as opposed to their regular, because they got 500 bottles approved as long as they weren't for consumer use, which was what the whole purpose of them was in the first place. But there we go. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out over time. But again, it's another perfect example of, we have this mixed information that consistently keeps coming back from the provincial government in regards to what's going on with this ongoing drug problem. Speaking of misinformation, There's a new report that came out in regards to the cost of misinformation when it came to COVID-19. For anybody who's been paying attention, it's pretty obvious that there has been a lot of problems with misinformation. In particular, misinformation comes to COVID-19. There's a lot of people who believe a lot of false things. There's a lot of people who got suckered into believing things that maybe they shouldn't have. And this new report spells out in a number of ways just how much that information hurt people and how much it cost people. The misinformation cost at least 2,800 Canadians their lives, and it cost over $300 million. The report is called Fault Lines, and they go through in quite detail. It's a very, very long report. We're going to throw up a couple of the infographics that they have in just a sec. It's a very long report, but it details incredibly effectively just how much this misinformation and disinformation caused real harm during the pandemic. It's also worth perhaps bearing in mind as we're about to go through that infographic that one of the big sources of misinformation and disinformation is somebody who is currently the Premier of Alberta. So when we're talking about what was the potential cost, what did all of this misinformation and disinformation do? Well, it caused an increase of almost 200,000 COVID-19 cases. There were 198,000 COVID cases that didn't have to happen. 13,000 hospitalizations that didn't have to happen. 3,500 ICU patients that didn't have to happen. Almost 3,000 deaths that didn't have to happen. And there were $300 million in hospital costs that didn't have to happen because of this misinformation and disinformation. Now, the report also includes some good tips on ways to recognize it. So it's simple, it's emotional, it's repetitive, it's visual and shareable. It's designed to mimic credible sources. And then it talks about the kind of damage that this misinformation and disinformation does. It also gives some recommendations and as to how to interrupt and how to prevent it from spreading. So it's a really important report, and it's one that's definitely worth paying attention to. So if you have the time, it's definitely worth taking a couple of hours and reading the thing, because it's really quite insightful, but it really does highlight the importance of being responsible for the information that you're sharing as well. Because there's a lot of things we talked about it a little bit on our recent episode. And I had a chat with Mr. Dean Blundell from the Crier Network talking about sort of how to tell if misinformation is misinformation. And one of the biggest things that we talked about is the idea that if it provokes a strong emotional response in you, it's because it's designed to do that. And if it's designed to do that, then you have to ask why. And that's really, really important, because there's a lot of people who are weaponizing misinformation and disinformation in order to advance their own goals. We just did a whole episode. This is where we're going to plug the episode a little bit. We just dropped an episode on Friday where we talked about an organization that has some, let's go with casual relationships with the facts and editorial bias, and asked a bunch of questions about, hey, how come you guys are all sharing post office boxes? Because there's a bunch of these conservative PACs and influence groups that are operating out of the exact same post office box. They don't have a real office. They don't have a studio. They don't have anything like that. They are presenting themselves as a major voice in Canadian media, but they operate in a cellular structure that is almost consistent with, like, I don't know, terrorist organizations, I'm told, do the same thing sometimes. They're very decentralized. And they have these one little post office box, well, two little post office boxes that we talked about that all of these organizations are running out of. Almost all of their headlines are inflammatory. Almost all of their stories are inflammatory, and they're doing that for a very specific reason. It's a serious conversation, and it's a serious topic that we had on Friday, but we also had some fun. So if you want to have some laughs, I have received a couple of messages from people who have said that a variety of beverages have come out of their noses forcefully during certain parts in the show where certain jokes were made. So if you haven't already checked that episode out, definitely encourage you to do so. Moving on from there. One of the big conversations that's been going on in Alberta politics over the last little while has to do with an organization called Take Back Alberta. They're a grassroots initiative that started in British Columbia, but they're grassroots to Alberta. So do with that what you will. And they are using all of the rhetoric to get people engaged in democracy and try to influence the not only the results of nomination contests, but also the results of board elections. We saw more than half of the UCP board was elected, that was elected at the last AGM, was candidates that Take Back Alberta had put up. But we've also seen recently, Take Back Alberta has been running a lot of candidates in UCP constituency association and general meetings. And they've been doing a very, very good job of getting a lot of their candidates installed. One of the best examples of this is in the constituency that belongs to Jason Nixon, who is a nominated candidate. Now, there were some concerns that some people raised in regards to that nomination, because there were a few people, one in particular, that was disqualified because of social media posts that had gone way back when. Now, there's for sure, we had a conversation with that candidate. His name's Tim Hovind. He came on the show. He was very clear that he believed that the social media stuff that had been used to disqualify him were taken out of context. He says he doesn't hold those views anymore. So, you know, do with that what you will. But he was very clear. You know, I feel like the disqualification process CP is currently using isn't fair. And in all fairness to Tim, politics aside, you take a look at all of the things that Danielle Smith has said, and she wasn't disqualified. And it definitely raises some very legitimate questions about, hey, how's that work? Because Danielle Smith has denied residential schools. Danielle Smith has advocated for alternative COVID treatments that are proven not to work. Danielle Smith has been caught oh, many lies. It's almost impossible to count. And she was allowed to run by the UCP for the UCP leadership. Now she's ended up as premier. So there are some fair questions to be asked about how was that meted out? Who was disqualified and who wasn't? Because there's some people who navigated the process just fine, who appear to have said far worse things than what Tim Hovind was disqualified for. Well, Tim involved with Take Back Alberta, for better or worse. And they organized a tremendous turnout for the AGM in Jason Nixon's constituency. And most of them were elected. They pretty much crushed that election and got rid of everybody who wasn't on their team. And they did so in the hopes of opening up the nomination. This was another thing that Danielle Smith promised that she was going to do. You know what? I'm going to reopen those. We're going to get everybody in who wanted to be in. We're going to get rid of all of these guys because nobody should be disqualified. I wonder if she has a vested interest in pursuing that line of reasoning. But the UCP has come out and said, you know what? You can't do that. There's no process by which to overturn a nomination that has happened. Now, remains to be seen if Jason Nixon will actually run, because dude's been pretty much invisible since Smith got elected. But he is the nominated candidate for that constituency. And the party has very clearly come out and said there's no mechanism by which to overturn that. So unless Mr. Nixon decides to say so long and thanks for all the fish, he's the guy. So again, this is another example of not just Danielle Smith, but the folks involved with Take Back Alberta simply not doing, they're doing their research, but they're not actually doing their research. They're not actually checking what the rules are. They're making promises that they can't deliver on. This is a consistent theme through that whole group. And as we saw with what we were talking about earlier in regard to the COVID advisory board, that's another place where Danielle Smith made a whole lot of promises that she's not going to be able to deliver on. So it's interesting. One of the biggest stories of the week, though, has to be the whole situation with Athabasca University. Now, this is a bit of a, we're going to do a mini deep dive here to try to make sense of this because it is complicated and convoluted. Basically, what it boils down to is at the beginning of the pandemic, well, first of all, before we do that, Athabasca University is a distance learning university. So they did a lot of stuff where they did like by mail before. They did some online stuff before too as well. But they're also an open university, which means that if you didn't complete high school, don't have any sort of academic background, you can still go to Athabasca University, you can get a general studies degree and you can use that to branch off into other areas of study, which is a really important thing because there's a lot of people who want to pursue post-secondary education, but sometimes life happens, especially life happens during high school. So it provides a really important pathway. And the combination of distance learning for people who are having to work and all of that, that really amplifies the importance of the services that Athabasca University provides. So there's that little bit of context. The next little bit of context that you need to know is when COVID-19 happened, Athabasca University said, hey, you know what? We're going to go all in on distance learning online. That's going to be our jam from now on. We're going to do the online distance learning. That's how we're going to provide all of our content. That's the road that we're going down. And there's some real advantages to doing that. One of the biggest ones is it means that instructors now don't have to be tied to that geographic location. And when we're talking about a small town like Athabasca, that widens the pool for the instructors that you're going to be able to draw from. It's not just people who are going to live and work in Athabasca. Well, the town didn't like that one bit, because Athabasca University has historically been one of the bigger economic drivers for this small town in rural Alberta. Anybody who's paying any attention to small towns in rural Alberta knows a lot of small towns in rural Alberta are dying, because that's what small towns in rural Alberta do these days. It's unfortunate, but it's actually a reality that a lot of small towns are facing. There's a group of people who said, you know what, we're not accept that. We're going to fight back. We're going to make them stay, because nothing makes people happy to live in a small town like being. I can say that because I used to live in a small town. So they started this grassroots movement. City council said, hey, you know what, we're going to give you folks some money. And they started petitioning the Minister of Advanced Education, Demetrius Nicolaides, to say, hey, can we go ahead and do this? And Demetrius Nicolaides started to make some moves, because the president of the university and a lot of people involved with the university said, you know what, this is actually a really good thing, this online thing. And it's important because it provides access to people who otherwise wouldn't have access. That's kind of our mandate. We're going to keep doing that. Thank you very much. Well, Demetrius Nicolaides started making some changes. So in May of 2022, he swapped out the chair of the board. And it's worth taking a look at who they swapped to, because the person that they swapped to has a long history with the Conservatives in Alberta. Not only did he run for the Conservative Party in 2015, he actually ran against Jason Kenney during the UCP, not during the UCP, the PC leadership that was the lead up to the UCP leadership. It was the lead up to the merger of the Conservative parties. So he ran against, he's a lawyer who lives and practices in Calgary. So if we're going to talk about, well, distance is bad, there's some questions to be asked. But that's who Demetrius Nicolaides appointed. Now, at the same time as he was doing that, he also threatened to do some pretty significant funding cuts to Athabasca University, which in turn would have had a pretty major impact on how they were able to provide their programming. Pretty big deal. But it went on from there, because one of the other things that Demetrius Nicolaides did is he got rid of a controlling interest of the board. So for anyone who's familiar how boards make decisions and do things, somebody comes up with an idea and says, hey, we should do this. And somebody else says, okay, well, we should have a vote. I second that. Let's do a vote. And then the board votes. If you want to have controlling interest of the board, a great way to do that is to get rid of a bunch of, say, four, and then bring in a bunch of other people, say more than four, who are friends with, who are maybe longtime conservative donors. We did a whole bit on how one of the guys is actually a heavy hitter conservative donor who is part of the Friesen, I believe it is, grocery chain. And there's been some questions about them in the past as well. So Demetrius Nicolaides got rid of the chair of the board. A couple months later, he got rid of most of the board and he appointed in all of the people who he wanted. Well, this week it came out that Demetrius Nicolaides kind of sat back and he let his new board that he set in motion do their thing, because Athabasca University announced after a long search that apparently a bunch of people didn't know about they had fired the president of Athabasca University because they found this other guy who's going to be great. But there's some very real questions about how that played out. And those were brought up in an article in the Tie, written by Charles Rusnell, where he talked about the fact, before we get there, the new president said, well, you know what? Maybe it wasn't best practices. Maybe we did some things a little bit shady, but it was legal. And the shady stuff is what came up in Charles Rusnell's article, because there were at least three board members who anonymously, confidentially, approached Mr. Rusnell and said, hey, you know what? I didn't get to vote. I didn't get an email. Nobody told me about this. I found out after the fact. So there were a bunch of board members who were apparently cut out of the process, or seem to have been cut out of the process. They feel like maybe they were cut out of the process. And this new president was brought in, and the old guy who was saying, you know what, this online piece, remaining online, not forcing people to live in Athabasca, that's going to be able to empower us to provide a better quality of education to the people who are attending our things. We should probably do that. Well, he's gone now. So there's that. Moving on from there. One other piece that we want to talk about in regards to the Athabasca University fiasco is we saw a fascinating letter that was released. And this came from the Athabasca University Faculty Association. It is worth reading because the Faculty Association pulls no punches in regards to how the president was fired. I'll read just a couple of excerpts. AUFA condemns the Board of Governors' callous firing without cause of the only president in years to openly defy the government, as we condemn the board's lack of transparency in hiring a new president. The board's actions demonstrate abuse of the search process and a disregard for collegial governance, says AUFA President Rhiannon Rutherford. Davina Bandar, a faculty member and AUFA constituency representative, expressed concern that the board is not working in the best interests of the university, but instead to further political gain for the governing party. Pretty much straight up saying that the board, who was appointed by Nicolaides, and the new president, who was appointed by Nicolaides, who ran for the PCs and who ran in the UCP leadership race, they're not actually looking out for the best interests of the school. They're looking out for the best interests of Nicolaides. Period. It's hard to imagine. I can't remember a time where I've seen a organization put out such a strongly worded letter. If you want to read the whole thing, it's up on our Twitter account. You can take a look at it there. Definitely worth doing because it really does speak to the process that happened here. Moving on from there, Tracy Allard. We did an episode a few weeks ago. Just heading into the new year, where he said Allard in. Well, it turns out Allard's out. So Allard was appointed the minister of the secretary of discrimination. Danielle Smith promised that she was going to appoint somebody to fight for people who were getting discriminated against, because the vaccinated are the most discriminated against people in the history of all of Danielle Smith's life, according to her. And she appointed Tracy Allard to do that job. Well, Tracy Allard posted a fairly long Facebook post where she talked about the fact that she will not be running for the UCP in the upcoming election. And the reason for that was in 2020, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and she's going to be stepping away from public life and government life in order to navigate that condition going forward. Tracy Allard is, of course, the minister who kind of kicked off the whole Aloha Gate scandal. And originally, there were two staffers who posted pictures to Instagram about what a wonderful time they were having in Hawaii after the provincial and the federal government had said, you know what, whatever you do, don't travel this Christmas, don't have family members over this Christmas. Those staffers decided that they were going to go to Hawaii together. Tracy Allard also decided that she was going to go on vacation along with a bunch of other UCP ministers and staffers. All of that being said, we're not going to make any jokes, because political leanings aside, political views aside, Nobody should be celebrating anyone getting diagnosed with Parkinson's. That is a brutal thing. It's going to be a very hard road for her to hoe, as well as her family. And so we're not going to make any jokes. We're just going to say that we wish her all the best with her diagnosis and leave it at that, because one of the things that we see happen far too often in politics is something bad happens to someone, and a lot of people line up to say, ha ha, you deserve it. And, you know, if it's consequent, natural consequences of action, that's one thing. If it's staffers posting pictures of their Hawaiian vacation and they, you know, lose their jobs. Allard lost her ministry because of that whole situation. There were consequences for her of that. Now, whether or not those consequences are efficient, that's up to lots of people to debate. But there should not be any debate as to whether or not dunking on somebody who's been diagnosed with Parkinson's is appropriate, because it's just not. So there's that. Moving on from there, we see another couple short little things that we just want to quickly touch on. And then we'll see what we do. Sarah Biggs is on her way to join us, I'm told. Traffic might be a little bit crappy, so I might have to vamp for a little bit. I was kind of counting on having the Twitter spaces running, but then the mixer melted down. So we're going to see how long we can make these last few stories last. Canmore has announced that they will be closing the obstetrics of their hospital all the way to the end of March because of nursing shortages. Now, this is happening on weekends. So during weekdays, if you're a mom who's about to have a baby, you're cool. If you can just plan it around the weekdays, don't do it on weekends. You should be fine. Otherwise, then you're going to have to travel to a different location in order to deliver your baby. It's really important to highlight, this is not the only circumstance and the only hospital that has had to shut down obstetrical services and labor and delivery services. The whole list of them. There's a Twitter account at YYC Cowboy who has been documenting them for weeks and months. And there's a lot of rural hospitals that are having, if not being shut down completely, they are having services stripped away from them because there is a staffing shortage. And as this only highlights that, as much as Danielle Smith wants to say, hey, you know what, we're going to reopen all of these operating rooms in rural hospitals that were built with the Lougheed era that were mothballed because they couldn't get staff back then. Well, as we face major staffing shortages throughout healthcare, Danielle Smith has said, we're going to renovate them all and they're going to be great. And we're going to have all of the surgeries going in there that aren't going to private companies. But we can't even keep obstetrical services in the hospitals that already have operating rooms. This should give everybody a whole bunch of pause. And it should prompt a whole lot of questions as to what the government's plan is going forward. And there's lots of people who have said, there's lots of leaders in healthcare who have said, there are no easy solutions to this. It's going to be a long-term fix. But there has not been any presentation of any detailed plans to address this issue from the government or any of the other parties that want to be the government. They're just saying, we'll make it better. We're going to fix the staffing thing. There will be more staff. Nobody's saying how. And one of the things that we need to be doing with an election coming up in just a couple of months is demanding to know how specifically. What are you going to do to fix these problems? Because just saying, you know what, we're going to fix the problems, that's not good enough, because it doesn't actually fix the problems. We got a fun one. Maybe two. we'll see how spicy I'm feeling, and if Sarah gets here in time to stop me. Danielle Smith tweeted out a lovely photo just a couple days ago, February 3rd. Alberta is so filled with so much natural beauty. My husband, David, and I love spending time with our dogs, Kane and Colt, exploring new walking trails around our home in High River in the Rockies. Danielle Smith loves exploring with her dogs in February, apparently in a short sleeve shirt with no snow on the ground. That's not a staged photo at all. We got some giggles out of that one. Let me see what else we have. I'm going to talk about this one. I might get in trouble from Sarah for doing it, but I'm going to. Talk about the Western Standard for a second. Because here's the thing. Sarah Biggs has been a commentator on the show for quite a while now. I think she started coming on the show about a year and a half. And it's been intermittent, but she's been fairly consistent for the last 6 months or so. And she does a bunch of other things. She talks about, she's a politico, she's a strategist. Anybody who's been paying any sort of attention to Alberta politics knows that for the last little while, or in the UCP leadership race, she was running Leila Ahir's campaign. And that was like 3 months ago, 4 months ago. But for reasons that defy any sort of explanation, the Western Standard has decided that out of all the campaign managers, out of everybody who's involved in the UCP leadership race, out of everybody who pontificates on Twitter about politics, they're going to write some stories about her. And they're not doing it fairly. Because they just put a story up. We were talking about the free speech bit that the Nicolaides also put forward this week. So for anybody who wasn't paying attention, one of the other things that Nicolaides did this week is he announced that he was going to force post-secondary educations to provide free speech report cards, in effect, because there was a whole situation that came up with a, some would say, disgraced university professor from Mount Royal University who tried to argue that, but, you know, residential schools had some good things too. A bunch of other comments that she ended up getting fired for. Well, she was going to do a speech at the University of Lethbridge, and the student body said, nuh-uh, we're not cool with that. And there was a lot of protests. There were a lot of people who were very upset about it, and it ended up getting shut down. Well, Sarah Biggs, who does some commentary on the show, put out a tweet where she said, you know what? It's kind of lame sauce that Nicolaides is backing her. It's not off brand for Nicolaides when you consider some of the content that he's produced, because not too long ago, he did a video where he sourced out and referred to the great inspiration that a one-time elected MLA who also happened to be, what's the words I'm looking for? Oh, right, a white supremacist. This was the guy that Nicolaides held up in his video. So for Nicolaides to come to the defense of this university professor who really wants you to know that there were some good things about residential schools, if you just look hard enough, which is obviously bullshit. Sarah had some thoughts about this, this decision, as did literally thousands of people on Twitter. If you read some of the stories from the University of Lethbridge where they talk about the cancellation, they were hearing from thousands of people saying, we don't want this here. Thousands of students saying, we don't want this here. But for some reason, the voice that the Western Standard decided to amplify and to highlight and maybe even target a little is none other than our very own Sarah Biggs. They apparently contacted Mr. Nicolaides for comment, but there didn't seem to be any effort to contact Sarah Biggs for comment. They just took her tweet and they ran with it, which is, some people would say, kind of a dick move. It's also not the first time that the Western Standard has done exactly that. Which causes a bunch of, it forces you to maybe ask a few questions about what is it about Sarah Biggs that the Western Standard finds so problematic that she needs to be gone after incessantly. And you can speculate, if you like, perhaps, about some of the reasons. I mean, Sarah Biggs was Leila Ahir's campaign manager in the UCP leadership race. And Leila Ahir is the MLA for Chesimir Strathmore. And there was an election in 2019 that Leila Ahir ran in, and so did somebody else. Who was it who ran in Chesimir Strathmore in 2019? I'm just going to quickly do a little Google search here, live on the show. Chesimir Strathmore, 2019. Let's just see what comes up here. Because I feel like maybe there's something going on here. Let's see. Okay, so in 2019, Leila Ahir ran for the United Conservative Party, and she walked away with 15,612 votes. Who else ran? There's an NDP candidate, Melissa Langmaid. She walked away with 3,558 votes, which isn't a shock when you consider how Chester Strathmore has historically voted. Who came in third place? Oh, look, it's Derek Fildebrandt, owner and editor-in-chief, I think, of the Western Standard. How many votes did he get? 1,683. So let me just walk through this just so that I'm not getting anything wrong here. Leela here got 15,612 votes in the 2019 election. Derek Fildebrandt, 1,683 votes. Leela here ran for the UCP leadership. Her campaign manager in that UCP leadership race was Sarah Biggs. And now the Western Standard, which is owned by Derek Fildebrandt, is irrationally pursuing Sarah Biggs and trying to highlight her. That's probably just a big old coincidence, I'm sure. There we go. That's what I have to say about that. A couple other things that I just want to highlight real quick. I just got another text from Sarah Biggs. She says that she will be on here in like 2 minutes. So I have to vamp without the benefit of saying, hey, Twitter Spaces, come on in. So I'm going to just talk about a couple of the episodes that we have coming up. We sat down with a Green Party candidate again. So for anybody who's familiar, has been following the show for a while, we've talked a little bit about this program called R-Star. And R-Star is kind of this very strange little program that seems to be based on the idea that, you know what, oil companies, you know, they technically have a responsibility to clean up the messes that they've made when they've done wells and all of that kind of stuff. They technically have a reason to do the cleanup there. But, you know, if they do, we should give them some bonus points. We should give them some royalty credits. Now, this program has been cooked up by somebody named Chris Kinnear, who went on after coming up with this program to reach out to a certain person who would later come Premier Danielle Smith, who lobbied the provincial government to look at R-Star. And the provincial government said, you know what? We actually believe that if you make a mess, you should clean it up because you made the mess. We shouldn't have to incentivize that further. So not only does this thing not make any financial sense, but, you know, polluter pays. It's kind of a thing. So no, we're not going to go ahead with the R-Star program. Well, Danielle Smith ran for leadership, and all of a sudden now we're as a province, we're looking at implementing, might go under a different name because rebranding, but we're looking at implementing a trial of a program that is very, very similar to the some might say identical to the proposed R-Star program. And the person that we have who is going to be joining us is a Green Party candidate for Banff Kananaskis, and his name is Regan Boychuk. We had him on talking about the R-Star program specifically, but we brought him on again, and we're going to be dropping that episode for our Patreon sponsors on Wednesday. It's going to be going live for everybody else on Friday, and it's actually a really fascinating conversation. I learned some things that I didn't know. So, for example, when we're talking about things like royalties, the royalty is basically what Albertans get per dollar based on what comes out of the ground. So for every dollar that the oil company, dollars worth of oil that oil companies pull out of the ground, Albertans get X amount. Back in the Lougheed days, it was like 35 cents on the dollar. So for every dollar of oil that came out, Albertans got to keep 35 cents of that. It's gone down, and it's gone down a lot. Regan's telling us that it was, it's as low as 5 cents now in the oil sands. Britons are getting 5 cents on the dollar. And it's important to highlight that when we're talking about the resources, these belong to the people of Alberta per the Constitution. That's a whole other side conversation that we could go down as well. But 5 cents on the dollar is not great when we're letting the oil companies and the gas companies take these resources out and then make tremendous profits. And Regan makes the argument in the episode that's coming up on arguably Friday that, you know what, we could solve a lot of our our issues, our economic issues, if we maybe bump that up a little bit. It's a really fascinating conversation. I learned a lot of things in it. And like I said, we're going to be airing that on for our Patreon sponsors. That's going to be going up on Wednesday. And for the public, it's going to be going up on Friday. And I just got another text from Sarah saying it. So I'm going to keep trying to vamp. And there's going to be some editing in the podcast version of this. I know there is. For the people in the comments, here's what I'm going to do. We have a lively comments discussion going on tonight. So I'm going to pop over to that and just see what's going on over there to buy Sarah a little bit of time. For everybody who's listening, I apologize again that my mixer melted after I worked so hard to get it working. Otherwise I would be desperately throwing it out to the Twitter spaces and asking for your thoughts on things and stuff. Ziad's got a comment in here. Exceptional import due to urgent public health need does not allow for stockpiling for next year. Urgent need now, which was also Ziad's talking about, again, Daniel Smith's drug problem, and mentioning the fact that the urgent need for the meds, the children's meds, doesn't apply because we have stock now. The reality is that when it comes to Danielle Smith's drugs, the children's medication that she paid for at a premium, this is another example of, you know, Danielle Smith has said a lot, I'm a problem solver. I'm good at finding the loopholes. And we talked with Ziad before about the loopholes that Danielle Smith found with his drug stuff. And it's shockingly on brand for Danielle Smith, because to recap the drug situation, Danielle Smith looked at the shortage and said, how can we solve this problem? And everybody said, well, everybody who makes these drugs is out. It's getting better, but everybody who makes these drugs is out. But their supply chain issue. And Danielle Smith said, you know what, let's go to the people who make the precursors. So the ingredients for the drugs without actually making the drugs. And what if we got those people, instead of just making the precursors, what if we got them to make the drugs as well? Well, that'd be clever. And when you add in the fact that the company that we're talking about, Atabay Pharmaceuticals, is owned by, was started by Dr. Oz's family. It gets really on brand for Danielle Smith really quick. But we also know that in order to get the company to do these things, they had to pay a premium to basically get them to upgrade all of their stuff, to do the things that they needed to do, to make the medications the way that they needed to be made in order to sell them in Canada. So there was a mortar, that's the 5 million bottles, and there was also a premium paid. Nobody has found out how much money this entire debacle has cost, and that's going to be one of the big questions. It's going to be really interesting to see as we lean up to the next election. And on that note, I got me a Sarah Biggs, and I'm going to make y'all stop listening to me vamp unnecessarily for extended periods of time. Sarah Biggs, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, sorry. I wasn't meeting anyone longer than I was supposed to. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
And of course, somebody was driving 50 in the 80 zone.
As always is the case. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Better now that you're here, because I was starting to go like, oh, what else can I vamp on?
Keep skating, Nate. I'm on my way.
So I want to get your thoughts on some things now here. We saw this week the official announcement from Jason Copping, where he was like, so the COVID Advisory Council, just kidding. We're not going to do that anymore, but it's cool because we're paying Preston Manning $250,000. So he's going to help with that. What is the messaging on that? Because it seems like that was one of the things that Smith campaigned on quite aggressively to her base, and to have that almost slip out during a press conference that was unrelated by and large. Is that how you would have strategized?
The first question I have is, did anyone they had in mind was able to pass the vet? That's number one. you know, they might have fell short a little bit on that side, because I don't think that, you know, a lot of those experts were able to, you know, provide because everybody gets vetted for everything on time, right? So there are certain processes that you need to follow. Very poorly done. Again, C's make degrees. The Bay is going to have to settle with what they get, which are still crumbs. Like, seriously, we're going to get... They just can't do everything right, can they? Or the Premier's office. They seem to be struggling with, you know, finishing a task. Seems like not everything is, like, fully completed. There's always a noobs. There's always a walk back. There's always a little bit of, how are we going to spend this?
It's like the Black Lives or the Black History Month tweet. That was, I mean, there were a lot of people when she tweeted out "are black." Whoa, maybe that's not the pronoun you want to go with there. And for her to wait 6 hours, or her comms team to wait 6 hours after some pretty heavy hitters, black leaders in the black community came out and were like, "Yeah, this ain't cool. This is not okay." Then she deletes the tweet, puts it back up, leaves the video that still has "our black" in there.
You're hoping no one's listening at this point. It's all.
So, like, is this legit? But that's my question. Is, like, the legit hope? Maybe people will just look at the new tweet and maybe they won't watch the video. Let's hope no one watches the video that we just reposted.
And we talk about that a lot in the past, right? They're hoping that people won't be paying too much attention. Like, not everybody has the time. So the attention span of, you know, not people like you and I, because that's what we do all day. That's what we just, you know, soak in all day. But to the average person who's watching the video and probably just went like, oh, especially for, you know, Caucasian individuals. But they just can't do it. Why do we get the dollar store version on time? Can we just do something right for once? Like,
well, it's, we're getting the dollar store drugs.
Fuck me. Money for the food bank. No, it's just, it's very, very disappointing that they do. Well, there's also an issue. I don't think they were able to reshoot the video.
Well, it would be a little bit hard, I imagine.
With a pina colada in your hands, but you know, they tried. We'll give them a mark for effort, but at this point, I think the bar is just.
But here's what my question, here's what my struggle is with it. Danielle Smith used the "our" in regards to a community that has been, like, literally owned. And somebody had the wherewithal to delete it and try to, however clumsy it was, walk it back. But when she has made those comments about First Nations and Indigenous people, there has been zero effort to walk it back. And at no point in either of these situations did we see Danielle Smith, who's going to do things like Premier Klein, admit her mistakes and learn from them, say, "Oh shit, sorry guys, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have used
that word."
She's
not capable. She's not capable of doing anything like that, though. That's the thing. She's not. So she's walking back stuff when she really, really has to, like the Alberta Sovereignty Act, or, you know, big pieces like that. That just, like, as per the Constitution, or how the law works, it forces her to walk it back. Like amnesty for COVID-19 individuals, actors that have been fined, and all those things. The things that she is forced to walk back on, or for an example, I don't know, the whole CBC story with obstruction of justice, when she said to Ezra, "I talk with them, you know, we had discussions." The things that, you know, that she has to, the things that are legally requiring her in order to get on the hot water, and that she has to walk back, or caucus is pressuring her to walk back, she will, and she's going to spin it. Okay, the spin sucks, but, you know, it is what it is. You can't ask for a perfect grade
95% of the time. But, you know, for things like that, she won't, she will not. But the thing that happened is that there's a lot of, you know, if I think about the Association of Black Conservatives, or, you know, there's a lot of stakeholders that probably called the premier's office and they were like, nah. But nobody was able to walk back the video because it's all public knowledge. The premier's on vacation. So they were not even, it is public knowledge, right? It is. It should be.
I feel like it is now.
Yeah, it is now. So, you know, they were not able to fully fix it. To that poor intern or junior comm person that tried to walk it back, you know, we'll give that person an effort. But is it just going to go down the ether? Absolutely. Because there, if there's any mistakes that are being made on communication, things like that, they're hoping that people will forget or they will not be paying attention. Then they're just going to keep on going with their day, right? It's not something that's going to keep them up at night.
Well, this is the interesting piece for me is, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, one of the people who called it out quite strongly with timestamps is a person named Heather Campbell here in Calgary. It's a fairly prominent person.
I love Heather Campbell.
Well, this is the piece that I'm going to pivot to, because Heather Campbell and a few other folks organized an amazing event on Wednesday to kick off the start of Black History Month. And there was some fascinating polling data that was presented there that talked about one of the wild cards in the next provincial election is going to be the fact that visible minorities, and I'm using that term so cautiously, because that was part of a big part of the conversation that happened that night, but they're going to be the wild card in this next election. And I think that there's going to be a lot of people who don't forget this stuff. I think there's going to be a lot of First Nations people and Indigenous people who don't forget that Danielle Smith was like, oh, I'm Cherokee because I got told that at the dinner table, and then disrespected First Nations and Indigenous people with the sovereignty.
Well, so, okay. So let's take it kind of community by community, right? Well, usually First Nations don't really get involved in provincial elections because their dealings, their treaties, their relationship is with the federal government, right? They recognize the federal government as the governing body and the crown, and not, you know, provincial government, not so much. They're the ones that are providing shitty social services, but that's pretty much it, right? And, you know, court system and all that. Sorry, I had to.
I'm not laughing at what you're saying
because it's just what it is. Like, they just can't do anything. Anyways, that's a conversation for another day. Then, what I have discovered, and especially this summer when I was working in leadership campaign and talking to a lot of pollsters, very often. So, what we need to keep in mind is that in certain communities, like Punjabi, Gujarati, Hindu, a lot of those individuals, so you have so in one home, you can have three or four generations in the same home. But very often, some of those individuals, A, don't speak English, or they don't read English, or do not understand what's going on in the political spectrum, like somebody that works downtown Calgary and reads the news every day, right? So very often the communities, some of those communities are not reflecting extremely well in pollings. So that's why I think it's going to be the wild card, because I think that a lot of those communities are seeing how everything's going, or very often the sample is so random, and very often some communities are more concentrated. There's a bigger concentration in certain areas, or, you know, in Fort McMurray, there's a big Hindu and Punjabi community. You know, the Filipino community, but is this reflected in the polls? Because sometimes when you're polling, it's so random that you might be missing like 75 of the communities. Like, let's say if you're not polling Calgary Northeast, right? Which is where the Hindus and the Punjabi and the Sikh and, you know, all those communities usually tend to live. So there's a big piece to that where I hate saying that, but sometimes the communities are not polling well. They're not reflected in, because A, you're not going to be talking your language, so they won't even listen. Or if it's a phone call, they don't know who that is. They're just going to hang up. And sometimes you're going to have 4, 5, 6 voters in one household. So you never know, really. It's a little bit of the wild card. And she's right. Heather's right. It is. But there's a lot of individuals as well. And they're like, you know, they might have been UCP supporters in the past. Now that they're seeing, like, some of this stuff is not great. And, you know, it's really contradicts a lot of their values and what they are. Like, you know, Ms. Campbell is a huge, huge proponent of transition. She is an engineer. She's working in the oil and gas sector. She's an amazing advocate for the transition, or, you know, green energy and all that. So I was so happy this summer. I saw her and I told her I loved her and made my day. She didn't know who I was. I was like, but can I just say that I love you? Anyways, but, you know, and I think that there's going to be, if the parties are doing it right and they're able to associate, we need to stop catering to the white crowd, guys. That's the thing. We have been doing politics for so long, catering to the white guys from downtown Calgary, downtown Edmonton, or the farmers, that we tend to forget that now 52% of Albertans are members of a ethnic community. We tend to forget that. And the more you forget about it, the worse it gets. And honestly, like, the wild card also is that people immigrated in Canada and they chose Alberta to be part of Canada. They don't want to hear about the sovereignty crap. They don't want to hear about it. They would be like, but why would we want to get rid? Like, I applied to come to Canada and I choose Calgary, Alberta as my home because they have a good education system and free healthcare, and healthcare is better than a lot of provinces if we're, you know, we're struggling. But my oh my, if you want to go to Quebec for, you know, a broken thumb, you might want to wait 24, 36 hours to get seen, right? It is that bad over there. But, you know, they chose Canada first. Then they chose Alberta second. You know, they want a Canadian passport. They identify as Canadian. And sometimes the very white supremacists, well, that some organizations are carrying, or, you know, the fear mongering and all that. It's all of that does not mix well together. So, yes.
Well, I think I said just a couple of episodes, like, one of the things that I find really problematic about the way that Smith and the UCP are doing things when it comes to the question of visible minorities is when we're I'm going to say new Canadians. That's what I'm going to say. When we're talking about new Canadians,
newcomers,
these a lot of the people who are coming to Canada, a lot of the people who are coming to Alberta are coming to get away from regimes or governments that abuse their power, that subvert democracy. And I find myself thinking that I don't think that the going to be too happy if anybody explains, hey, this is how Smith has been doing things.
It's so short-sighted, Nate. It's like if I would take off my glasses and try to stare at the screen and write a full policy slate of policy without my glasses. Like, nothing makes sense. It is not. It is so focused on one very specific group that it does not. It just doesn't have the. It's very short-sighted. It's very unfortunate. It's. Can we just stop being so white? Can we do that? Can we say that? Can we just stop being so white? Like,
well, this is here's the thing. I mean, like, I go back to I did a conversation with Dr. Jared Wesley, who I just can't say enough good things about, and a while back. And one of the things that he talked about was an exercise with the organization that he does. The organization is called Common Ground, and they ask people, you know, what does a Albertan, you know, think of an Albertan? What do they look like? What comes to mind? And it is heartbreaking to me every time he tells the story that the number of people who view an Albertan as the the white person in the cowboy hat.
When my mother came to visit me for my wedding a while ago, pre-COVID, she was like, so we were driving. She was like, where are the oil sands and where are the pump jacks? And, you know, I was like, well, that's up north. And then we drove down to Diamond Valley, and we're like, we are on one of, you know, the biggest and oldest oil fields in the province. And there's a lot of misunderstanding that we're seen as hicks with trucks and a lot of money and just, you know, some consumption issues. When I go home and I go visit my family, they're like, smells like oil, smells like money. But there's that we're just so much more than that. We're so much more. And that's why it's infuriating when we see that they're making all the efforts in the world to make rodeo, like the provincial sport, national sport. I don't know how they called it, but it's so infuriating because we're so much more than that. It's like this week, it's Chinese New Year this month. There's a lot of, it's like we have Diwali in the fall, and it's extremely, extremely important. There's so much more than just stampede cowboy hats and short skirts. And, you know, I'm tired of that stereotype of we're just whiny babies who refuse to work with everybody, who refuse to talk to everyone, who's trying to, you know, we're so obsessed about oil that we don't even want to hear renewable. It's exhausting. And it's honestly like, can we stop being so white, please? Like, we are a walking stereotype, and that needs to stop, because Alberta, it's like the Hindu and the Punjabi community in Edmonton is massive. The Francophone community in Edmonton is huge. And La Cité Francophone and Campus Saint-Jean. You look at everything. You look at the Jewish community in Calgary. It's a big community. You look at Calgary Northeast. It's like an ecosystem on its own. It's fantastic. We're so much more than hicks with truck nuts and, you know, Dodge 3500 diesel with Hemi engines. I don't know. We have a story communication problem. We've been talking about that for a while too. We do not know how to communicate our story. Alberta is this, Alberta is that. Alberta is not just what the government wants us to be. We live on treaty land. We have an amazing, amazing, you know, the First Peoples in the province are amazing. Yeah. It's an amazing culture. We need to make space for them. We need to make more space. But to think that the white people right now, guys, think about it. People are a minority, and we need to keep that in mind. And we're in 2023. We're not 1953. And it's time the government get with the times. But even if you look at healthcare, if you look at the way we approach healthcare for women from different cultures, you know, mutilation, genital mutilation is still a thing. There's a lot of things that are happening in the background that, you know, some white dudes from, I don't know, from Rocky Mountain House Sundry, I'm just going to give that as an example.
Oh, you opened
they might not understand there. How, you know, they might not understand how a Punjabi woman from, you know, Northeast Calgary, you know, there might be a culture clash, and, you know, it's not culturally sensible. And, you know, we're bitching about Quebec, how Bill 21 is racist. We're pretty much, sometimes a lot of people are expecting the same thing, but they're thinking it like very, very down low and not putting it in the bill. But if we're complaining that Bill 21 Quebec is racist, just look at how everything's integrated in the province. The education system, the healthcare system, social work system, and everything. And tell me that we do not have a systemic racism problem in this province.
Well, it's not like we have a premier who has said that the unvaccinated are the most discriminated against group that she's seen in her lifetime. That's not emblematic of a systemic racism problem.
Was
at
she
all.
Born in 2020?
I don't know. You brought up Sundry. I'm going to go there. So we've had this conversation a few times, and I've been saying, I don't think it's going to happen. And we saw the UCP come out this week and say, yeah, take back Alberta, nice try. There's no mechanism by which to reopen nomination. It's Jason's, suck it up. How does that play out? Because here's the thing, Smith's on vacation right now. She's not available. Nobody gets to be like, hey, Danielle, you said you were going to reopen these nominations. We went ahead and we took over the CA and we got everything in place. We did everything that you told us to. Where's the love, Danielle? Nobody gets to do that. But at some point, there's going to be a conversation about you promised that you were going to reopen these nominations. You walked that back. We did all the work. And now the party is saying, sucks to be you. How does Smith play that out?
Well, the thing is that it's not necessarily how Smith will play it out. It's how the executive of the party is going to play it out, because it's pretty much a 50-50 split at the party level, right? I would like to see some, I would like to see if Smith has, as the president, well, the leader of the party, not the president. Sorry, Cynthia. I'm so sorry. Hi, by the way. I miss you. Not really. So we need to think about if she has a voting seat on the board, if she has a vote on the board, that's super important. But we need to see, like we talked about it like 3 weeks, a month ago, and we're like, we're really going to see who's leading the party when the decision for Rocking Mountain House, Sundry, Rimby, and Aria when the decision will be rendered. Because technically, so David Pisco, director of comms at the UCP, said it's not reopening. There's no way we can't. But again, I'm sure that in the background, there's a lot of people talking and trying to figure out. But Van Voot and Pisco, they've been clear. We're not going to be reopening it. But will the board play by the rules? I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is where it gets particularly interesting, because if, let's say, as a hypothetical, there's really two ways that this can go. Way one is Danielle Smith says, hey, guys, I told you, sorry, I was going to stay out of it because we don't want leaders messing with things, especially not prosecutors. But I said I was going to stay out of it. I'll have to stay out of it. And then the board says, yeah, we're keeping Jason in because we like donors. And Jason Nixon gets to stay the candidate, assuming he runs again. I'm legitimately curious if he's not going to wait till like a month or a couple of weeks before the election and then just be like, yeah, never mind. Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, because he's been so quiet. But that's one possibility. He keeps the nomination. That's the end of the story. The other possibility is Danielle Smith says, or the board says, hey, you know what? Even though there's no rules that allow for this to happen, we're going to overturn this nomination.
Because it was not fair.
Okay. But here's the thing. Here's where it gets interesting for me.
Please, no sarcasm in my voice.
Oh, I know I did. If you go down that road, if the party executive can at any moment decide that they're going to overturn a nomination race because, I don't know, it's a day that ends in Y, why am I going to run for that party? How are they going to have anybody who's going to take running for that party seriously? Because at any point, the executive can say, you know what? We had a democratic process. It was what it was. We're going to overrule it because it's Tuesday.
Because we don't like it. It doesn't fit our narrative.
Yeah, sucks to be you. We're a grassroots democracy party, but we're just going to overrule at whim. Like, that is a fascinating road to go down. And it makes me wonder, like, how are you going to convince people to run for your party? Because if somebody in the background, like, here's the thing. Nixon won the nomination. Like it or not, Nixon got the nomination. And if the argument's going to be, if the argument's going to be that if there's enough people in the background who make a big enough stink and take over your constituency association, then we're going to completely rewrite the rules. We're going to completely do things arbitrarily. Not only is that a fascinating, I think there's a word for that, starts with an F, ends with ashism or something. But once you go down that road, how are you going to get people to donate to the party? How are you going to get people to be invested in the party? Because the only people who are going to do that are going to be people who are hyper engaged anyways.
The people with money will not be donating to the party. That's why the party needs to be extremely careful. So when we're looking at that, okay, so let's make a list of moderates here for a second. Open bracket moderates. Travis Staves, Jason Nixon, Sonia Savage, Jason Gopping. Those are true moderates. Gottfried is out. Rutherford is out. But if you look at the ones that were considered like a little bit more far right or not considered like centrist moderates, like not the crazies in the party, those guys bring a lot of money to the table. So the party needs to be, and maybe the UCP or whomever is listening, they might want to take a few notes here, or you can call me after that. You got my phone number anyways. They need to be careful because there's a lot of big donors associated with those candidates that could just go bye-bye very, very, very fast because they are not interested into, can I say hick politics? I don't know how to call it anymore. Like hyper-organized, fear-mongering, lying and tie whatever restrictions we have left. You know, maybe they're protesting against the whooping cough vaccine now. I don't know, or the vitamin K injection when a baby's born. Who knows? But, you know, that very misinformed crowd or the players that be that are just fear-mongering to primal fears. So what's interesting, so there's a psychological game into that. There's also a money game. So the psychological game is, okay, we're getting more members, more people are coming in, we're getting money with memberships because we're making people believe that they're going to be losing everything if they don't get involved, if they don't listen and, you know, go our way. That's because that's a message that is being conveyed right now with somebody that has a little bit of a, you know, God complex. I'm not going to say it too loud because he might come after me again. Let's see on Wednesday on the Western Standard what's going to happen. But
I just did 20 minutes on the Western Standard before you joined.
Oh, did you?
Sorry about that.
I missed that. It's okay. It's fine. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But then the party needs to be mindful that all those glorious dollars that were coming your way, Brian Jane dollars, Travis Staves dollars, Nixon, like all those guys, the money could have gone poof tomorrow morning. And they forget that. For what? Again, to entertain a very small faction of the party. It's just like, oh yeah, go elections, freedoms. Why?
Because so here's my question.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of a fascinating book called Slumming It at the Rodeo. I believe it's written by Gordon Laird. It's older. It's from the 90s, like me. It makes the argument over long term. I haven't finished the book yet, so maybe there's like a surprise ending where it turns out Stephen Harper and Preston Manning are the same person or something. I don't know. But it makes the argument that a lot of what we see as conservatism, especially the more populist conservatism, is actually not that. There are deep corporate interests that are pushing these people forward, and these people who are using populist rhetoric to get to the places that they need to be in order to make the things that they want to have happen. And when we take a look at somebody like Daniel Smith, I mean, the more that as I'm reading through this book, I'm like, man, this all fits really, really well, because Daniel Smith campaigned on a profoundly populist approach coming out of COVID-19. She made a boatload of promises that she has failed to keep. She has done an incredibly effective job advocating for corporate interests. I mean, even the R-Star thing, it's dumb as all hell.
With our Sovereignty Act, everybody's pissed off.
Okay, that's fair. But the Sovereignty Act was always the flagship piece. And, it was... Let me finish though, because let's look at Daniel Smith not through the lens of the populist COVID nutter. Let's look at Daniel Smith through the lens of she's been involved in politics for 2 decades. Mm-hmm. She has been attached to all kinds of corporate interests for decades. We've seen that a lot of the donors that she had during the Wild Rose days, some of the big donors or some of the people who are advocating for some of the biggest projects in Alberta right now, those are the projects that she's advancing, COF, Train to Banff, COF. The R-Star program would unquestionably disproportionately benefit especially large oil companies, because they're the ones who are responsible with their cleanup anyways. Usually it's the small guys who are fucking around. She like has done well. She worked with lobbyist groups. She worked with she was the president of a group that advocated for corporate interests in Calgary for a good chunk of time. So if we take a look at Danielle Smith and her policies, what she's actually enacted and the things that she says she's going to actually enact, she's not so much of a populist. She's pushing for the big corporate things. And I think that when we take a look, even Mr. Kenney, he did the same thing. He did the same pivot. He campaigned going up into 2019. He was able to hit all of the major social issues. That's why we were talking about GSAs, because he was like, oh, John Carpe. But when the rubber hit the road and it got time to actually making legislation, he made a couple of performative pieces. But the vast majority of his policy, corporate tax cuts. Big money for the corporations who said, thanks, see ya.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just saying, I think that there's part of the conversation that has to include the possibility that Danielle Smith has done an incredibly effective job of looking like she's just one of the folks, but her loyalties, when you look at her policies, when you look at what she wants to enact, aren't that. No. She's making sure people are getting paid.
Do you remember when she was a tobacco lobbyist with Ezra?
Yep. Cures cancer. 75% of all chronic health issues could be resolved if people just smoked more.
Yeah, she should talk to my grandmother. She died at the tender age of 54 in 2005.
She said that, though.
Not everybody went to science school, right?
True.
No, you're making me think a lot. But what's fascinating, too, is that we need to take in consideration that a lot of the big corporation, there's a lot of money in the backgrounds. A lot of the large donor will be having I can't even talk about that.
But this is why it's so interesting to me.
They're financing both sides because they want to make sure they're being heard on both sides.
I don't think they are. I think when you take a look at Take Back Alberta, Take Back Alberta is bragging about the fact that the vast majority of their, I mean, they're probably getting some donations because there are nutty rich people out there. But
I'm talking about UCP versus NDP.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Everybody's bet. Like, most people are betting on both sides of the track, for sure.
They're hedging their
bets. For sure. But when we're talking about the UCP, the point that I'm trying to make is if we go down the road of the overwhelming majority of Jason Kenney's policies favored corporate interests. Overwhelming majority of Danielle Smith's policies favor corporate interests. I don't think she and the UCP are going to go down the road of alienating those corporate interests by leaning too far into the TBA rhetoric. I think that they'll entertain the TBA rhetoric and the populist rhetoric. They'll make them feel like, you know what, it's okay, guys, we get you. But I think when the rubber hits the road, I don't think that Danielle Smith is going to alienate all of the major donors that she needs.
She will if some of the major players are leaving and pointing out to her on the reason why they're leaving the party. If, you know, when you're saying when the rubber is going to hit the road, if TBA is making too much space for themselves and keep pushing, because, you know, there's some messages out there. It's different. They really think that Danielle Smith is the chosen one. And I think that they're going to be so loud that they're going to be creating their own space. And then, you know, in the media and all that, there's going to be guilty by association kind of style. I think that's why I Yes, the corporation was, well, you know, not the corporations. They don't give money.
No,
the individuals in those corporations will be making.
They can give it to PACs, though.
And they will be.
Or registered charities.
I'm not.
True to joke.
But I think that they might be taking their dollars somewhere else. Where they think that, because, you know, if you're creating, yeah, she speaks all business. She's like, oh, let's make better for businesses and this and that. But really, you want to create an Alberta revenue agency, creating more red tape at the payroll level, because you think that everybody's going to be sending you your money when they're going to have to do two remits. Hey, Danielle, you should know that. You do payroll for your husband's restaurant. Number two, you know, when you're creating a very, very unstable economic or political, geopolitical environment, provincial level, when we're like, well, maybe Alberta is going to be, you know, pulling the plug, it creates, you know, a lot of non-confidence for investments, right? So we're going to have to see if she's doubling down on that next election and see how it will be perceived from the business communities. Because if she's doubling down on that, I can tell you, I don't think it's going to go that well on the big dollar guy sign. They're not going to be happy about it. They're going to be like, oh, you're from Alberta. Like when the Sovereignty Act came out, I spoke to some people. They already had like $25 million of funding pulled out under their feet like this very same morning. It's already hurting businesses. And I think that, you know, they're, some might be resigned to be supporting the UCP, but the more moderate ones or the ones that really understand what's going on in the background, I don't think they're going to be putting their money there. Two bits.
That's fair. I just look at like, I mean, even let's take a look at what they're doing with healthcare. We're selling off the interfacility transfer parts. So somebody's getting paid. We are taking a look at surgeries and we're doing more and more chartered surgeries. They're promising to do even more. Somebody's getting paid. They're Danielle Smith's government, Jason Kenney's government beforehand for sure, but Danielle Smith's government has accelerated the moving of public dollars into the private system. And I think that the populism piece is a convenient. I think for Smith there's a little bit of real just because she is that. But I think at the end of the day, I think that the populism piece and the entertaining a lot of the TBA folks is to some degree convenient theater.
It is. How did she get there? How did she squeak by on the sixth round? It's because she had 44,000 people. It's like, you know, do you remember that press conference when everybody was there and calling off like, don't, the Alberta sovereignty is dangerous and all the other leadership campaign? And they asked the question, and I always remember, like, I was in the back room because I was at the press conference. And at the same time, we got a message that the queen has died. And then you have one of the candidates being asked, so where do you recommend people to mark Danielle on their ballot? The right answer should have been nowhere, but they said number seven. And that was one of the biggest mistakes of the campaign, because that assured her the win. Because it's like, oh, are we going to pull Danielle six? Or are we going to put Todd Lowe in at number seven? Like, you know, when, you know, that really... Sorry, I got a lot of frustrations about that. But, you know, if companies are seeing that healthcare is being privatized, they're going to be looking at other options like Vancouver or Ontario. But here's the thing. The difference between Danielle Smith populism and Doug Ford populism, it's not the same kind of populism. Businesses might be choosing Ontario because here's the thing. Doug Ford has a customer service client first, happy customer mentality. Danielle has a, you will say as I do, I don't care about except my very little echo chamber. Like Doug, everybody wants to go for a beer with Doug. Like he's a good guy. He seems okay. Like a buck of beer. Let's go.
I don't.
I'd go for a beer with Doug. He's, you know, he's a dude, right? He's just, you know, but
it's these scenarios that make me glad I don't drink anymore.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, those were the days though. But, you know, it's not the same sort of populism One is, and yes, there's a lot of stuff happening in the background, but I think that an investor confidence would be much, much, much stronger in the current political climate in Ontario and in Alberta. I can tell that's, and there's so many federal investments for plants and all that in Ontario. It seems like we're missing the boat. It's unfortunate, right?
What are you watching for this week? There's a deadline.
Hold on. Okay, so tomorrow is the leadership candidate filing deadline. How do I know that? I don't know. And then on the 7th, it's the first minister's health conference with Justin Trudeau.
Is she going to be back? Is she going to make it?
I don't know.
Is she going to send Casey?
Fuck's sakes. Hi, Casey. Hi, Minister. Hope you're doing well.
Who's the other? Is it Newdorf that's the other one? Who's the other? Yeah,
Newdorf, Mr. Ledbridge. Yeah.
I wonder, does she, if you're Danielle Smith and you're enjoying a tropical beverage in a tropical locale, who are you sending to meet with Justin Trudeau, Newdorf or Madu?
Oh, Minister Manu. Hey.
Like, I'm going to be interested to see how that happens.
We're going to see what's going to happen. I really hope for the sake of the problem. So, Mike, let's make a thing. Okay, what time is it? It's February 5th, 9:37. I'm saying that if the premier is not attending the first minister's conference, it's because she will be running a very aggressive, the feds won't work with us on the healthcare fund in the next election. She's going to be putting it at the forefront of everything. And she's going to be throwing in all the transfers and all the equalization formulas and everything. Then the water, then the babies, then the dogs. And then she's going to bring in grandma to make sure that it fits her narrative. Then she's going to be feeding that. Then you're going to have the Western Sender just being like, oh. And then you're going to have True North being like, oh, give us some money so we can report more bullshit. And then it's going to be like, then we're going to have Ezra dancing around all of this and be like, so, Premier, what are we going to do? Happy Easter. I really hope she shows up, because if she's not showing up, it's such a disservice to the province. And it's so dishonest, considering you don't want strings attached to your funding. Well, there's always strings attached to funding, Premier Smith. It's like when you're going for a car loan, you got to pay every month, or you got to prove that you have the income, or there's some strings attached on everything. And it's called personal responsibility and public service and public duty. If you're asking for money and you're not willing to spend it where it should be spent, to try to increase privatization and, you know, circumvent around the Federal Health Care Act, and, you know, JT won't be playing with you, don't blame it on the feds, blame it on yourself. Shame on them if they're trying to pull that one out. Shame on them.
It will be interesting to see if she goes or doesn't. She hasn't tweeted, hey, just landed in, or anything like that. The last time that she tweeted anything was 5 hours ago, and it was, do you want to guess who she retweeted? Do you want to guess?
What?
True North.
Like, okay, seriously, they need to be declared. Okay, so they cannot be a non-for-profit anymore. They are not at arm's length from the premier. They are pushing. I need to stop talking because there's going to be more hippies. My mental health, guys, I need to protect it.
That's fair. Speaking of that, I'm probably going to do a Twitter thread after the show, but I'm going to take the opportunity to just say something real quick, and then we'll wrap it up. Yeah. Because we're coming up to 10 o'clock here. There you go. You know what's awesome about anonymous Twitter accounts?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that means? There's no way that you can be accused of defamation or libel because you don't know who they are, because they're anonymous. So for all of the little anonymous Twitter accounts that have crawled out of the woodwork over the last 48 hours since we put up the True North piece, I'm reminded of a bit from my favorite TV show. It's called The West Wing, written by Aaron Sorkin. Some of the best writing that you're going to find.
I have the full box set.
As do I. If you're throw personal attacks at someone from behind a anonymous Twitter account, I can only assume that you're doing so because you're a coward, and that you're doing so because you lack the fortitude or the will to actually come out and say these things yourself. You're doing it anonymously because you're afraid of the consequences. You do it anonymously because you don't have the courage to stand up and say these things with your name attached to them for reals, because you know that if you said half of the bullshit that you spew from these anonymous accounts, you would be in a position where you would have to deal with libel, and where you would have to deal with defamation. And I can only assume that some of the people who are behind these anonymous accounts, who are doing their very, very best to troll, are doing that as a specific legal strategy, because I don't know. I can only assume maybe they have a little bit of legal knowledge that they're basing this strategy on. And if you're doing that, let me be clear. You're a coward, and you're a little tiny person, and you're not worth my time. You're not worth Sarah's time, and you're not worth the time of anyone involved with the show. I have said many things on this show, but when I do, I sign my name. And if you don't have the courage to do that yourself, you're not worth it. You're a coward. You're a little person. That's all I have to say. Sarah Biggs, anything else you want to throw out there?
No, nothing. I locked down my social media accounts, and it's the best thing I've ever done.
I went after the Western Standard pretty good.
I'll have to go watch it. Sorry, guys.
You're going to want to play that back.
But no, just keep getting engaged. Follow what's going on. We're 3 weeks away from a budget. It's my husband's birthday this week.
Well, happy birthday, Sarah's husband.
Happy birthday to Sarah's husband.
I just want to throw a little caveat on there, because there's somebody who came up in the chat. I don't have a problem with anonymous accounts. I totally get that there's some people who need to be anonymous. And some of the things that the Breakdown Done has done in the past is that's totally a thing. But if you're like deliberately going after someone and just shit posting them from an anonymous account because that makes you feel safe, you're a coward, period, end of sentence. So I have to say, I'm gonna wrap it up, and I'm gonna remember to throw the graphic up, because we have the fun little boom. There it is.
I'm disappearing. Bye.
As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here at The Breakdown, we would love nothing more than if you signed up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab. It's because of our Patreon support that we're able to do the kind of things that we do and produce the kind of content that we do. And if you liked any of the content that we've done, particularly over the last week, supporting us through Patreon is a fantastic way for us to continue doing that. I also want to quickly announce, for those of you that are paying attention to the Fruited Machine right now, you probably have noticed we've got a Substack now. We've had a bunch of people say, hey, you know what? I love the videos. I love the episodes. I love the live streams, but I really wish there was something written that I could refer to. So we're going to try to do that. And so we're going to be posting Substacks every Sunday after the show to kind of try to round up and provide some links and sources for the things that we've been talking about on the episode. And if you hop over to our Twitter, you'll be able to find that right there. That's all we've got for tonight. Big thank you to everybody. We had a super active chat tonight. Big thank you to everybody who is in the chat. I want to say an especial thank you to the people who are coming by to troll there. I think that's super fun how we're not worth watching. But here you are. Good to see you fixed your caps key, though. And big thank you to everybody who sat through the Twitter spaces. I am so sorry that the mixer died. I'm going to try to get it resolved for Wednesday so that hopefully we'll be able to have the opportunity to have the two-way conversation that the Twitter spaces does enable. But if not, hang out on the comments on all of the things, because they're absolutely, I love seeing the comments. They make my heart happy. Other than that, as always, take care of yourselves. Have a good week. If you haven't watched the True North episode yet, I strongly encourage you to do it. It's a lot of fun. And like I said, the fact that I've gotten multiple messages from people who have said that they have laughed so hard stuff, milk and coffee and beverages came out of their nose, that just tells me that we're doing something right. So I want to say thank you to everybody who sent those messages as well. Take care of yourselves and keep the conversation going.